So we're entering into the last few messages in this series on the life of Abraham, a series called The Crossover. And the message today is kind of the beginning of this transition into the final few messages that we find in Abraham's life. And really, it's a transition to the journey of the end of Abraham's life in the narrative of the book of Genesis. So over the next few weeks, we're going to be looking at, for instance, today, what it means to say goodbye. And the message is titled Grieving with Hope. We're going to look later on in coming messages at the idea of leaving a legacy. We're going to talk about even faithfully living into the twilight of our years. So as we begin this transition towards the end of Abraham's days, today specifically, I want us to see through the eyes of Abraham what it looks like to grieve with hope. And we're going to talk about how we see it in his life and ultimately how it's a theme that we see throughout Scripture. So I'm going to be reading from Genesis chapter 23, verses 1 through 20, if you want to follow along, if you brought a Bible with you, but the words will also be up on the screen behind me. Genesis chapter 23, starting with verse 1. We read that Sarah lived to be 127 years old, and she died at Kiriath Arba, that is in Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went to mourn for Sarah and to weep over her. Then Abraham rose from beside his dead wife, and he spoke to the Hittites. He said, I'm a foreigner and a stranger among you. Sell me some property for a burial site so that I can bury my dead. And the Hittites replied to Abraham, Sir, listen to us. You're a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of tombs. None of us will refuse you his tomb for burying your dead. Then Abraham rose and bowed down before the people of the land, the Hittites, and he said to them, If you're willing to let me bury my dead, then listen to me and intercede with Ephron, son of Zohar, on my behalf, so he will sell me the cave of Machpelah, which belongs to him and is at the end of his field. Ask him to sell it to me for the full price as a burial site among you. And Ephron the Hittite was sitting among his people and replied to Abraham in the hearing of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of his city. No, my lord, he said, listen to me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. I give it to you in the presence of my people. Bury your dead. Again, Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in their hearing, listen to me, if you will, I will pay the price for the field. Accept it from me so that I can bury my dead there. And Ephron answered Abraham, listen to me, my lord. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver, but what is that between you and me? Bury your dead. And Abraham agreed to Ephron's terms and weighed out for him the price he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver according to the weight current among the merchants. So Ephron's field in Machpelah near Mamre, both the field and the cave in it, and all the trees within the borders of the field were deeded to Abraham as his property in the presence of all the Hittites who had come to the gate of the city. Afterward, Abraham buried his wife Sarah in the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre, which is at Hebron in the land of Canaan. And so the field and the cave in it were deeded to Abraham by the Hittites as a burial site. So we see in this passage that Abraham has come to the point in his life where he must say goodbye to Sarah. Now, Sarah and Abraham, as you know, if you've been with us for this series, know they did not have the perfect marriage or the perfect relationship, right? They left home on this adventure that they didn't know where they would land. They waited forever for a son, for Isaac, and it seemed like it was going to maybe never happen. I'm sure that was extremely stressful for them, so stressful that they had the Hagar and Ishmael episode in the midst of everything. Sarah found herself not once but twice in the harem of these foreign kings. She laughed at the promises of God. She entertained visitors, heavenly visitors. So they didn't have the perfect relationship, but they had each other, and they had each other for a really, 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 really long time. But it's in this passage that we're told Abraham has to say goodbye. And when he does that, we read that he was mourning and weeping at the loss of Sarah. And it's interesting that both of those words are there, that he did not just cry, because that would just be the idea of weeping, but he was weeping and mourning. And those words being joined together tell us that it wasn't just crying tears at the loss of Sarah, but he went through what would have been the mourning customs of his day. It would have including rending or tearing his own garments and disheveling his hair and cutting his beard, scattering dust and ash on his head, and fasting. So Abraham not only cried as evidence that he cared deeply for Sarah, but he went through the mourning rituals. Now, obviously, these look foreign to us because we don't do them today. We have an entire different set of mourning rituals that we do when we lose someone. They look nothing like this. But these are the things that Abraham did because he loved Sarah and he lost Sarah. And you have to wonder, or at least I did as I was studying the passage, why is this detail explicitly recorded and not just assumed? Why is it that we're told that Sarah died and that Abraham wept and mourned as a result of losing her? And I think the reason is this. Because in the Bible, many times and in many places, including this place and on this occasion, the Bible gives us permission to grieve and to mourn. I think it's there because it's a reminder that that's how we're created and that it's okay, in fact, healthy to go through these phases of grief and mourning and loss when we experience hurt and heartache in our lives. And can I tell you a secret? Culturally, we stink at mourning and grieving. On the whole, we stink at it. We're terrible, right? The general attitude of culture is, listen, we know you're hurting, but really what you need to do is lessen your grief. You need to sanitize your grief, maybe even entirely deny it, take it away, and do it on your own in a corner somewhere in a dark room because you don't want to make everybody else sad, right? We have been culturally conditioned and trained to bottle up our grief, to deny that it even exists, to contain it, to hide it, or at the very least, we are trained to get over it as quickly as we possibly can. I mean, we live in a world that looks at grieving people and says, really, still? You're not done with that yet? And yet the Bible gives us a completely different picture of what it looks like to grieve and to mourn. For instance, if I had to ask you, and I won't pull the room, but if you had to guess what percentage of the Psalms, 150 Psalms, what percentage of those Psalms deal with lament and grief and mourning and the feelings and the emotions that go along with it? So just get a little mental number. I'm not going to ask you, I'm not going to quiz you, but how many of the Psalms, what percentage of them deal with those themes? And the correct answer is about 40%. 40% of the 150 Psalms deal in some capacity with grief, lament, loss, and mourning, right? If you've ever felt in life like you're hurting and in pain, if you've ever felt in life that you're upset that God seems to have withdrawn his presence from you, go to the Psalms. They're a fantastic prayer book when you go through those valleys of life, the valley of the shadow of death, to quote one of the most famous ones. But there's more than that. We read in the Old Testament, Jacob and David and Job, among many other people, when they grieved, they would wear this fabric called sackcloth, kind of a rough burlap. Well, you guys know, you all have your burlap shirts that you put on when you grieve, right? It's in your closet. No, of course not. Again, because the customs change over time. And why would they do that? Why would they put on a burlap-like sackcloth? Isn't that really uncomfortable? Yes, and that's the point. It's an outward symbol of clothing of what's going on in our hearts and our souls when we grieve and when we mourn and we go through that time of discomfort. I mean, how about this? People, there's an entire book titled Lamentations, an entire book of the Bible that is dedicated to the idea of what it means to lament that something has been lost, to grieve and mourn something that was loved that is now no longer with us. And if you need any further evidence, I think the best one is in the person of Jesus, because when he loses his friend Lazarus and he stands outside of Lazarus's grave, what does Jesus do? He weeps. So if you ever need permission to grieve and mourn, I think Jesus giving you permission is all the permission that you need. So culture may tell you something about grieving and mourning and loss, but the Bible tells you something very, very different. And we see it in Abraham's life, that he goes through this process of weeping, mourning the loss of his wife, Sarah. And we're going to get to, in a few moments, how he grieves with hope. But what I want us to take a look at is, in the midst of this grieving and the mourning, there are practical things that Abraham needs to care for. And it's in the midst of these practical things that, once again, we get a glimmer, a little slice of the character of Abraham. And I think it's important that, especially as we near the end of his life, we take the time to look at his character and how it developed and where it is now in this journey with God, right? And so we look at this practical discussion about arrangements to find a burial place for Sarah, and we see some of Abraham's character. And one of the important things that I think we should remember is that this discussion happens with, they're labeled several times, the Hittites, the people of the land. These are not people who share Abraham's story of faith. These are not people on the inside of what it means to know God, to come into relationship with him. So we're looking at Abraham as someone who's having these exchanges with these people who are sort of kind of on the outside of his view of who God is. We read that the discussion itself takes place at the city gate, and we read that and go, so what, it's of no consequence. Yes, huge consequence, okay? Because this is a legal transaction now. If you needed something legal done in Abraham's day, there was no courthouse you could meet at, there was no lawyer's office that you go to and sign a pile of paperwork with all those yellow stickies so you know exactly where to put your initials and your signature, none of that. How did you get things done legally? You went to the gate of the city, and you met with the elders of the city, the influential people, and they became your witnesses, and whatever happened there at the gate of the city in front of those witnesses became legal. And if there's ever any question, there's no documentation to pull up, but you go to the people who are there, and they say, yes, that's exactly what happened in this place. So there's some gravity to what's happening because of where it happens and with whom it happens. And in the midst of this conversation, Abraham asks for the cave, right? He says, please, I'd like to get the cave. And what, in response, does Ephron offer him? Well, I'll give you the cave and the field. I'll give you the cave and the field. Interesting, because that's not what Abraham asked for. So as the reader, you know there's something going on sort of under the surface here. I'll give you the cave and the field. And Ephron uses the term that we translate give three times in verse 11 alone. I give you the cave, I give you the field, I give it all. But please make no mistake, there is no giving, getting something for nothing happening here. That word give is kind of a euphemism for buying and selling, or at least, at the very least, the idea of I want to give you this, assuming then that you're in my debt for something in the future that I need to collect on. Ephron's not super interested in actually selling the piece of property, which is why it takes this whole discussion to get to that point. So don't think he's being, oh, it's so nice of him to give everything. That's not what's really happening here. Probably the best way to try and understand is if you've been in a situation where there are no price tags and haggling is expected. I've been to Jamaica several times, and if you've ever been to a Jamaican straw market, that's what happens there in that style of doing things, right? You stop and you say, oh, it's really nice, I'd like to have it, right? And they say to you, oh, well, on a day like this, for a pretty lady like you, I could let that go for an extreme flattery, right? They want to engage you. And the assumption is that you'll engage them back and say, well, no, I couldn't possibly. It's very nice, but I could only give you so much. And you go back and forth and back and forth. And there's little slices left, but that's how all ancient Near Eastern stuff was done. So no one's giving anything away. Probably the best example I could think of when I'm connecting what I'm reading with my own life happened on my honeymoon, actually. My wife and I got married and way many years ago, 17 years ago at this point. We got married. We did our honeymoon to Gatlinburg, Tennessee, right? So we did all the things in Gatlinburg that you do. Walked up and down. We went to little shops. We tasted fudge anywhere they offered for us to taste fudge. And then eventually we come along the street and there's somebody on the street saying, "Hey, would you like free tickets to a show tonight?" Free tickets? I mean, we're newlyweds. We have no extra money. Absolutely, we want free tickets. Yeah, we'll take them. Well, I don't have them here, but if you meet me here between 3 and 5 tomorrow, I'll give you your free tickets. Great! We got all the time in the world. We're on our honeymoon. We got nothing else going on. So we go and we arrive, and some of you know where this is going already because we get to the place where we're going to get our free tickets, and the real cost of the free tickets is sitting through a 2-hour spiel on our opportunity to get a timeshare. Yeah, you've been there. So are they really giving us anything? No, the cost of those tickets was 2 hours of my life I will never get back on my honeymoon. No one is getting anything for free. That's why they go back and forth and back and forth. They eventually land on a price, 400 shekels, and I love in the text, Ephron says, "The price for the field is 400 shekels, but what is that between friends like us?" The answer, if you look at the amount of land and the amount of money, is a lot. Like, it was essentially price gouging because Ephron knows that Abraham's not looking at multiple parcels. Like, this is what he wants and what he needs. So he kind of is using him in that moment. He's treating him somewhat unfairly. And it really, and this is where, to me, seeing the sliver of Abraham's character, Abraham could have fought back. He could have said, "Oh, that's totally unfair. Here's a better price." But Abraham, He at this point in his life, he picks and chooses his battles wisely. And I wonder if we've learned that same lesson as Christians. Again, especially, don't forget, Abraham speaking to people outside of his faith story. Have we determined when and how we need to, quote-unquote, pick our battles or choose our battles, especially if we feel we're being treated unfairly? Because I think many times when we feel like we're being treated unfairly, we pick and choose all those battles. Instead of saying, "God, where are you in this?" And we don't have to pick and choose every single battle. There's a level of discernment that we see in Abraham's life that I think we can look at and that we can strive for. That wisdom and discernment that he had right there in that moment, even though he felt he was being treated unfairly. And that's not the end of his character. We see not once but twice, we're told that Abraham bowed down to those Hittite men around him. It's interesting to note that that same type of phraseology happened when Abraham was visited by these angelic visitors way back several chapters ago, that he bowed down before them. Abraham showed great respect and reverence for these people who are not family, not part of his household. Again, not part of his faith story, and yet he shows them great respect and reverence by bowing down before them. And he says to them in the text, "Guys, I'm just a foreigner and a stranger. I'm a person who needs and relies upon your gracious hospitality." But they respond back, and what do they call him? "Oh no, sir, among us, you're a mighty prince." Actually, the original text even says, "You're a mighty prince of God." So Abraham kind of puts himself on a low level, says, "I'm just a stranger and an alien among you." And they say, "No, no, no. You mean so much more than that to us." And it's a reminder to me of what we read in Romans chapter 12 when Paul's writing to the church in Rome and he says, "Do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment in accordance with the faith God has distributed to each of you." Don't put yourself up on a pedestal. Now, in Paul's letter to the Romans, this is couched in the context of the body of Christ. Among the body of Christ, don't think of yourself more highly than you ought, placing yourself above another part of the body. But I think it's just as true as we interact with those who are outside of the story of our faith. As we seek to live out a gospel witness to the world outside of the church, one of the things we can't afford is for Christians to be viewed as people who think that they're more important or more valuable or more righteous or more deserving than other people. We need to exercise that sober judgment. And sober doesn't mean sad in this context. It means sensible, reasonable, decent, and disciplined. Don't place yourself up on a pedestal, but have an accurate view of who you actually truly are. So I love it as we get to the end of Abraham's life, his character over these, well, over 100 years has been continually formed by this God that is walking with him. And in the end, they agree upon the price, and Abraham takes possession of that land. The burial of Sarah, though, is not just mourning. The burial of Sarah is also an act of devotion and an act of hope. And here's what I mean by an act of devotion. That whole scene of Abraham acquiring that burial plot emphasizes that Abraham was absolutely determined to give Sarah's body a place of rest that would be undisturbed and unquestionably his. I mean, they may have not have had the perfect marriage, but he loved Sarah deeply. And the fact that he fights so hard and takes probably an exorbitant price for this land shows that he is devoted to giving her a place of rest. Because remember, he's not a settled person yet. He still expects to be a traveler. And I think he wants to know, when I come back to this place, I want to know that this is my place and that she will be here. But it's not just devotion, it's hope as well. It's an act of hope. Because for people in the ancient culture, the place of burial, the place of final rest, was tied to this idea of rightful belonging. So by placing Sarah here, Abraham is essentially proclaiming that she and he together, this is a place of rightful belonging for them, here in this little chunk of ground that he has just purchased. And what's interesting to note, it is no coincidence that we're reminded twice in the text that we read today that Abraham is purchasing this place, this burial plot, which, by the way, won't just be for Sarah, eventually for Abraham and their son, their grandson, and their wives. And do you know where it's located? It says twice in there that it's located in the land of Canaan. It's the promised land. Abraham now, at the edge of his life, is finally seeing the manifestation of just the sliver of the promises God made to him so long ago. So when he lays Sarah to rest, it's an act of hope. It's essentially Abraham making this statement of hope with his actions. God promised that this land would be mine, and this is only the first step in realizing that promise, that there is so much more good yet to come than God's plans and promises. And I was mulling over and typing down some of those words, and I had this instant flashback to like 16 years ago. Because if you've been with us that long, you remember that about 16 years ago that Pastor Mark Hedlund was here, and he had this thing that he did, and I'm going to do it, and you are immediately going to be taken back in a time machine, right? Because if you were here, all I have to do is hold this up. Yeah, and if you were here, you know, right? He had this joke about dessert and keeping your fork and things like that. And the tagline was this, and you can say it with me, the best is yet to come. And I think what Abraham is doing by burying Sarah in the land of Canaan with this piece of ground that is now his is saying there is more yet to come because God's promises are just starting to be fulfilled. We read about this truth in Hebrews chapter 11, that famous chapter on faith. It tells us that Abraham and Sarah and their children and grandchildren, they were still living by faith when they died, and they did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. They were looking for a country of their own, a better country, in fact, a heavenly country. So Abraham, yes, indeed, was just seeing the beginning of a promise, but a bigger promise than even he understood, that there was more yet to come than he could possibly come to grips with. Because God not only established this place, this soil, this dirt for his people, and Abraham starts to see a sliver of it, there's so much more than that, this heavenly country that God has prepared for his people. And because of that, when we grieve and mourn, and we should, when we lose people, when we lose dreams, when we lose things that have deep meaning and are part of our identity, we should grieve, but we should grieve differently than the world grieves. 1 Thessalonians puts it this way, brothers and sisters, do not grieve like the rest of mankind who have no hope, for we believe that Jesus died and rose again. Amen. I love it that it says, don't grieve. It says, do grieve. but grieve differently. Because the end is never really the end through Jesus.